Just a quick warning, this podcast series contains discussions about crime, trauma, sexual abuse, drug use, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Andrew Chung spent a lot of his life in prison and jail. He's come out and he's turned over a new leaf in the fitness industry. Andrew Chung, welcome to The Stick-Up.
Thanks for having me, mate.
Man, I'm stoked to have you. I love you guys. I love all the ConFip guys. I aim to get every single one of you on the podcast because I think you guys have got amazing stories. And I just love that whole concept of how that right mindset and fitness can change people's lives.
Yeah, it's true. I really wish that I had someone teaching me fitness from an earlier age because even when like I look back and I see a lot of the guys who got into fitness early, I'm not saying that their lives are perfect, but their lives are a little bit better off. You know, and I wish I learned that discipline so early on. I wish my parents put me through like a fight gym early or just put me into the gym so much more earlier because, yeah.
I'd like to start off about your upbringing. Where'd you grow up and what's your family background?
So I'm a Vietnamese. I came here when I was 1 or 2 years old. My parents brought me, okay, I flew here.
Yeah.
So parents are immigrants. My parents settled in Bankstown early on. And we were moving around real early. Like, I didn't understand the concept when we were moving around, but as I got older, all right, cool. And we never owned a house, always rent. Landlords were always kicking us out because they wanted to move more people in, make more money, whatever. And I got used to moving around. So I moved around from like inner west, Bankstown, Villawood. And then when my parents finally bought a house, they bought it in Busby, so southwest. Towards Green Valley. And that's when I started to settle in and I changed a little bit because of the people that I was growing up around.
Yeah.
So I'd say like early on when I was in primary school, I was a really good kid. Like I was smart, intelligent. My parents sent me to school. I behaved. I didn't get into much trouble. Like I went out with my mates, but we'd go to the skate park and just hang out. Yeah. You know, we weren't getting up to any trouble. Then
what was the family structure? How many kids? Just me, only child.
So growing up, I was like, my parents were never around because they were at work.
Yeah.
Same. Like their goal was to save for a house and buy a house because we were sick of moving around all the time.
Yeah.
And so they were always gone. Like the moment I woke up to them, like just before dinner, they'd come home. And I remember growing up, my parents fought a lot over money issues. Yeah. And for a period of time, my parents were divorced too. I remember waking up, parents already gone. I'd get myself ready for school, go to school, come home just before dinner. Parents would come home and then cook. And then that's all I saw them.
Mine was very similar and I relate to it. And what was school like for you? Were you a good kid at school?
Yeah, I was relatively a good kid at school. I never got into much trouble.
Yeah.
It was only when I got into high school, that's when I started to get into trouble. So
What do you think was the underlying issue of that?
I'm going to say environment. But also, a part of me wanted to hang out with the cool kids.
Yeah. Acceptance, yeah?
Yeah, acceptance. A place of belonging because I feel like when I was growing up, I didn't have any siblings.
Yeah.
So I always felt alone. Like when I came home, it was just me and myself watching TV. Mm. I was always by myself.
Yeah.
And then when I went to high school, I had to make new friends because I moved schools too.
Mm.
So I wanted to belong. And fortunately, I wasn't weird or anything. So they took me in really well. Real easily, and unfortunately, they were the kids that were getting up to trouble all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were from like broken homes and that.
Yep.
And it didn't help that we got away with a lot of things. Like we got away with a lot of bullying, a lot of bullying growing up. I guess.
Were your peers, were they Vietnamese, other Vietnamese kids, or what was the mixture?
It was actually a good mixture. So we had like half the crew was like Asian, a couple of Islander boys. And always with that token white guy, one token white guy in our crew. And yeah, like I remember throughout high school, I remember my first maths teacher.
Mm.
I remember this real vividly because in school, like kids were protected. Kids are protected in school. If you pissed off the teacher to the like red line, you're still safe. They can't hurt you.
Yeah.
They can't hit you. They can't do anything. Like kids would push the buttons. And I remember my first year, it was unlucky for this teacher, my maths teacher. I'm so sorry, Mr. Din, if you're watching this. It was his first year too. And he was like getting used to his way of teaching. And we were just pushing the lines, like the boundaries. Like we would mimic everything he'd say. Just And I remember one of the boys was like, "Bro, hit me." We would just completely act up. But now I look back, maybe there were underlying issues where we weren't getting attention at home or all of that.
Validation, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a lot of things probably
part of. That's a big part of youth, that validation, seeking out that place of belonging.
Yeah. And I feel I wish I could sit down with all the boys and have a conversation, figure out why did we act up so bad. And it didn't help that one of us did it and no one pulled each other up. It was like we were all doing it. We all found joy in it.
Yeah.
And then over the years, because we got acted up in class and we built like a crew, we just became like the boys and just started acting up around other people too.
Yeah. And that's that whole validation thing. That whole validation thing, you know, like it's same with me. Like I relate to everything you just said, that, you know, that wanting to be a part of something. But also the family unit, like when the family unit's disjointed, you find your family unit in other kids.
Yeah.
And amongst your peers.
Yeah. And I felt I never had a brother. I never had someone so close to me like that I'd seen every day and I spent like literally every single class with and hanging out with after school. And that's where I was like, all right, those are my boys, those are my brothers. Mm. You know, that's the closest thing I have. And it didn't help that the year groups above us were doing negative things. We just followed in their footsteps too.
Yeah.
Because they were like an older version of us.
Yeah.
Like I looked at the older year groups and look, they started smoking. They started jumping the fence and just leaving school whenever. They were fighting with other schools. Some of them were getting locked up in juvie pretty early too.
Yeah.
Getting kicked out of school. Just real.
It looks rock star, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. It doesn't help that they got all the hot girls too.
Yeah.
It didn't help. That didn't help too. Like all the hot girls are hanging around those boys and you're thinking in your head, we're already halfway there.
It looks appealing. I get it. Same with Mount Druitt. We're growing up in Mount Druitt. It's like you see the bank robbers and all the criminals. You go, fuck, that looks good. And we realize later on it wasn't that good. And you just realize the harsh true reality. And what happened? When did you first start getting into trouble? What sort of things were you doing?
So it started with just real, not harmless. Like me and the guys would just hang out on the weekends and after school and that. And then one weekend, I remember this, we came back from Westfields, just a bit of shoplifting, kid stuff, a bit of shoplifting, and our bus stop from the Westfields stopped right in front of our school, and it was the school holidays, and we thought, let's just go into school and have a look around, wander around. Anyways, we jumped into the school, and the first thing I see after walking around the school, like we all split up, running around the school, just having a look around, see what's open, see if anything's like still open. First thing we see is my mate throwing you probably remember this. Back in school, we used to have the overhead projector.
You'd copy off.
Yeah. I'd see my mate launch an overhead projector over the balcony. I didn't know we were here to break shit, but yeah. So that kind of G'd the rest of us up to start doing other stupid, silly things and like pissing on doors and running around, just breaking things.
Yeah.
Anyways, we were just very unfortunate. That moment we were jumping out of the school to leave the school, a cop car was just driving down the road. But they were driving down there's a like specific bus road called a T-way.
Mm-hmm.
We thought they didn't even see us because it was so far away. Turns out they saw us and they came back and done a Yui and caught us for it. First time getting in trouble, I was actually scared and worried because they full dropped me off at home, told my parents, all this, that. And then fast forward a little bit, I was like, that kept me out of trouble for a bit because I actually thought, fuck, my life's gone in the wrong direction. And then I realized it was just a slap in the wrist. Nothing was ever reported. Like the school didn't press any charges. The school didn't even kick us out. And I'm like, that's weird. Nothing happened. Okay, cool. And then that's when I started to go back into the path of like, all right, well, get out of trouble every now and then. Yeah.
And you were, from a young age, you were pushing boundaries. It was like one of those things, huh?
Yeah. And then it didn't help that all the parties that we started going to from the age of 16, everyone was drinking already.
Yeah.
Everyone was already drinking before 18, like before turning 18. I'm like, all right, more rules to be broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you ever get locked up in the juvie?
And luckily I didn't, because one of my close mates, the same guy that threw the overhead projector over, he was the first out of our group to get locked up.
There's a mourning when that happens, isn't it? It's like losing something. It's like someone's died. I remember when the first one from my group got locked up, I was mourning him and thought, and we wanted to be with him.
Yeah. And it was like, we were all trying to find out if we can get in contact with him. It was very hard.
Mm.
And at the same time, we didn't really change our ways.
Mm.
I'd say we wanted to see him. The boys would still do what we used to do.
Mm.
And so the boys used to drink up with him and stuff, and we'd still continue to do the same things.
Yeah.
But we never got caught for it.
And then fast forward, let's go. So obviously crime escalated. Were you doing crime for money? What happened?
So fast forward, the guys that I hung out with at the time of like my young youth getting in trouble, like we all dispersed.
Yeah.
The boys went their separate ways. One went to work, one went to another school.
Mm.
One dropped out of school, so I was left with a new group of boys.
Mm.
And it was more of a positive influence because I started focusing in school a little bit more.
Mm.
But the problem was I still go on parties.
Mm.
Anyways, fast forward a little bit, I was still, I'd say I wasn't focusing as much as I should have been. And I failed my year 12. So I got to year 12 and all of that. Tried to study in school, tried to do the right thing, but I failed. And I think that put like a real dent in my belief, my self-belief. Because I got to year 12 and they're like, oh, you got to repeat.
I'm
like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not repeating.
Mm.
So I decided, oh, I'm going to go to TAFE.
Mm.
I go to TAFE and I wasted 2 more years.
Mm.
I didn't end up getting my HSC at TAFE. It should have taken me a year, but it took me 2 years.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, all in that time, I'm still a very social person. Mm. I still go to the parties. I'm still mingling with everyone. And it's like that young adulthood part of your life where you're just given this freedom now. You're an adult now. You can go do whatever you want. You can go party. You can stay up late. You can do whatever you want. And no one tells you what to do anymore. So I'm still getting used to that kind of lifestyle. But also, those things cost money.
Mm.
Being an adult costs money. You got to pay for petrol now.
Mm-hmm.
You got to pay for food when you're at TAFE.
Mm.
You got to pay for drinks when you're going out. You got to chip in for birthday presents. It's all these extra things that I never knew I had to pay for. And then because I'm still going to these social events, I'm going to raves too.
Yeah.
The raves was a very big thing when I turned 18.
Mm.
And I started selling pills.
Yeah.
And I started selling, pills and weed was the first things I started selling. And I was just leveraging off my social network. Mm. So because I already knew everyone from partying, I was starting to tell everyone, hey guys, I'm selling pills. If you guys need for the rave, let me know. And then that's when I started just going into the life of crime.
Yeah. It's funny, people will talk about easy money. They'll talk about that. I was just with Low Key. He's a music producer for Ahun Cho and he owns nightclubs. And I was just talking to him and there was nothing easy about it.
Yeah, was
with a benefit of hindsight, you know what I mean? There's nothing, I get these, the haters going, yeah, you took the easy way, you took the easy money. It was nothing easy, 23 years of jail, and all the headaches and the police and the paranoia and everything like that goes. Let's talk a little bit about that. So let's talk about what you were doing and how you were going about it and sort of even talk about what you're making.
Oh, yeah. So I started real small. So what I'll do is I'd buy 100 pills. Mm. Yeah, 100 pills. For cost price, probably $10 each, and then I'd sell it for $25 each. So I made $150.
Yeah, 150% markup. Yeah,
wasn't much, but it kept me fueled for the small things like food, petrol, basic necessities. I was working at, I had a job, part time job, Cotton On. I was getting a 3-hour shift once a week. That was not enough to.
But that what happens when you go into that sort of lifestyle, you feel it's giving you your independence.
Yeah, it does. It gives you a little bit of power. Like it feels like you're finally in control of your life. You're getting something.
But eventually it robs you of it. That's the
I didn't learn the hard way. So what happened was the cops raided my house.
Mm.
So I felt like someone told the cops because they raided my house and they had a search warrant for MDMA pills.
Mm.
That's what they were looking for.
Someone told them.
Yeah, that's what they were looking for.
Mm.
And what they found in my house at the time was a BB gun.
Mm.
So I was charged with a firearm because it was classified. Anyways, I spent like the weekend in jail. I got bail for it, but I didn't get bail like straight off the bat because the conditions was I had to give up my passport.
Mm.
But they took my passport when they raided my house.
Mm.
So I didn't know my passport was in my property the whole time.
Mm.
Anyways, when I finally got out, I got introduced to selling heroin.
Mm.
And that was because I didn't snitch on no one. Mm-hmm. And one of the boys was like, hey, bro, if you need a runner, I know someone who just got out. He's a soldier. He's good. So they introduced me to selling heroin. And that's when I started seeing the money.
Mm.
Like, I was like,
fuck. Serious money.
Yeah, yeah, I was like, fuck, this is way different to selling pills. Because pills is seasonal.
Mm.
Raves come around maybe towards summer. There's not much raves going on in winter. You're not going to make much during winter. But when summer hits, bro, you're selling like heaps. And I would... Back then, I would bring in pills into the festivals too. Mm. And I'd sell like for like ridiculous price, like 50 bucks per pill.
Yeah.
Anyways, but when I started selling heroin, it was more consistent. And that was the period in my life where, I don't know if you remember, but during that time, that was during the ice epidemic.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so when I started selling heroin, it was way past the heroin 90s.
Yeah, the drought.
Yeah, the phase. Yeah. It was way past that. I started selling heroin during the ice epidemic when the ice junkies were attacking the paramedics and all of that.
Yeah.
In my mind.
I think heroin addicts make ice addicts look like fucking angels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think so. I'd rather deal with a heroin addict than an ice addict all day.
That's what was going through my mind at the time. Mm. I was like, man, these guys are like low key. These guys just call me up and they just need to get through their day.
Mm.
They just don't want to hang out and that's it. Yeah. They leave people alone. They call me. They just need to function every day. Mm. That's the only reason why they're calling me.
Yeah.
So in my head, I was telling myself that was my logic. You're
justified.
Yeah, that's how I was justifying everything. Mm. And the way I used to see it was, well, if they're not going to get off me, someone else is going to give it to them.
Yeah,
they're going to get it one way or another.
Yeah, you're a necessary evil. So to speak. Now, that's what we are. Like, I get it. I get it. I've said the same thing. Not that I've been a big drug dealer, when someone tried to bag my heroin dealer, I'd say he's a good bloke.
Yeah.
He's only doing what someone else would do.
Exactly. And, I remember a customer from towards the city, he became real close to me.
Mm.
He became, he relied on me, and I made sure that I always picked up the phone for him because he always came through for me too.
Mm.
And... you feel like sometimes, besides the fact that the line is client and customer, but sometimes you feel like the bond is just a little bit more because they need you to survive.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, and that's how I was justifying it in the back of my mind.
Mm.
But at the same time, at that point in my life, the money was like...
What were you selling? Were you selling packets? What were you selling?
Anything between 50 to half a gram to a full gram to balls to an ounce.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah.
Yeah. It's a whole different thing. I want to just go back to it, mate. It's a full-time job, eh?
It is. From the moment I got up, 6 a.m., my phone would ring.
Yeah.
And I'd be out all the way until 8, 9 o'clock, sometimes even 10 at night.
Yeah.
And I'd just be driving around to whoever's calling.
Yeah. And what's happening? You're saving money? What were you doing with your money? Because easy come, easy go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So because that was the first time I got a taste of having consistent real money coming in, I didn't know what to do with it.
Mm.
I obviously, the logic would be save your money and then put it somewhere and then reinvest into something else. But for me, because I never had that kind of money and I was still seeing all the guys that I was influenced by, they were in the clubs spending on girls. Mm. They had expensive cars, expensive watches. They were just blowing money. And at that time in my life where everyone's turned 21, everyone's having that 21st birthday,
Yeah.
We're always in the club for birthdays. I just started blowing my money all the time.
Yeah.
It was...
You think it's never going to end, don't
you? Yeah, yeah. So, that Saturday, I'd spend it all. That Monday, I'd make it back. Tuesday, I'd make it back. And I'd be back to where I was. Mm. So, I just kept blowing my money every time I made it.
Yeah.
And if I saw something I liked online, all right, cool. If I was playing a game I liked and I wanted to spend money on it, didn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just felt like it was an endless pocket.
I know, man. I can remember going to buy a shirt and you buy one of every color, not looking at the price tag. It's a good feeling. But tell me, how did it start to come undone? Did you feel any heat on you, or was there an undercover sting? Or
this is a funny story how I got undone. This is actually a pretty good story. There was surveillance on us, me and my Coey at the time. So me and my Coey had a house in Fairfield, stash house, but he lived there because he had no family. So he was living at that house. And we used to have one friend that would come by, but he'd just come by and play FIFA with us. Mm-hmm. So he was one of our boys. But, yeah, he just played games with us. Anyways, that morning, he left the house and then he got pulled up and he rang me straight away. He tried to tell me that he got pulled over to let me know. But I was in the city having lunch at the fish market with one of my girl mates. Anyways, I looked at the phone and I'm like, why is he calling me for? He probably just wants to play FIFA because that's what he always called me for. But really, he was trying to call me to tell me that he just got pulled over. Fast forward to that afternoon, I came back to the house. And as I left the house, I got pulled over at the petrol station. I'm going to rewind a little bit, yeah? Back to the same morning. My Coley left the house. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what happened, yeah? So all of this is happening and I didn't know what was going on. My Coley left the house and he got pulled over. But as he got pulled over, he legged it. He just ran. He was like, I'm not getting arrested. He ran and he was just throwing everything out as he was running. He's got all his like 50s and 150s made up and he's throwing it out of the saddie, out of the sandwich bag until he's left with just a 50 because he wanted to, he was smart. He was like, I'm only going to get charged with possession. I'd rather just get charged with possession. He wanted to play the image of as being a junkie. So they finally catch him. They arrest him. They took him down to the cop shop and they charged him with possession. But it was Fairfield police. He had to leave the station and he was running back on foot back to the safe house. As he was running back on foot, because the safe house was in between a public school and a primary school, he jumped the back fence of the preschool and he was just about to jump back into our house, but that was the same time that I got arrested at the petrol station. And then they sent the coppers in to raid the safe house. And as they're raiding the safe house, my Coley is sitting there in the sandbox looking through the side fence and he's like, oh my God, we're fucked. Yeah, we're fucked. So if he got back a little bit earlier and I didn't leave the house that time, like everything could have been avoided.
Yeah.
Everything could have been avoided. He was literally a couple of minutes away from getting back to the house and cleaning it out.
Yeah.
And then that's how I got done. But what I got charged with also was, because I only got charged with a couple of ounces. I should have gave me 2 years. But because I had some substances from a friend of mine, another story actually I'll tell you. So one of my mates, someone owed my mate money. And he tried to get the money back, but he couldn't. The bloke didn't have anything to give him. But what he had was all these dud pills. And my mate said, give me all these dud pills, whatever. And they were like, actually duds. I've had like 20 of them. Nothing. Felt nothing. So my mate's like, you know what? I'm going to crush this up and I'm going to put some MDMA in it and I'm going to mix it back and then I'll press some pills. Long story short, he never got around to it. I was just holding on to that powder. And then when I got arrested, that was about, I think, 250 grams worth that they arrested me with. So that was commercial supply.
Game changer.
Yeah, commercial. I went from just regular supply to commercial supply. Yeah. And then when the lab results came back, it came back as this thing called fluoroamphetamine. Just because of the fact that it had the word amphetamine, that when the judge looked at it, and it was during the time of the ice crisis, the judge he was like, all right, that's 4 years at least.
Yeah. On the bottom?
Yeah, 4 years on the bottom, 8 on top.
Yeah.
Yeah. So half in, half out.
Yeah. So what happens here? You got arrested, charged with that. Did you go to MRRC?
Yeah, so I came in. I didn't get charged with it straight away. I was still on remand for about 2 years. Went in at MRRC and I remember when I went in, I was just like in an absolute state of shock because
Darcy unit.
Yeah, Darcy is. Darcy's
an induction unit where you go into and it is like something out.
And I forgot that the last time I was there, like at night, you have the spinners just screaming all night. I forgot and it was like, oh, back here again. And I was in so much disbelief because the last time I got out because, I don't know, I just thought, because I was in that belief where I'd get out of this. For some reason, I just thought it was always a bad dream and I'd get out of it.
Yeah.
But this time when I was sitting there, I'm like, fuck, I'm actually fucked. Like, I'm actually fucked this time. Like, I'm doing time now. Like, I've always gotten away with things. Like, before I've been arrested and charged with carrying in just a couple of caps into the festivals. And I've always gotten away with, like, you know, just slapping the wrist, possession charges. But this one time I just knew, fuck, I'm fucked.
Like, it's a harsh reality, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a harsh reality. And I was like, fuck. And like, when you get done and you've had all these, you've planned like your whole week before that, like, oh, I got to do this week, I got to do that this week, I got to do that. all that goes out the window and you're like, fuck, what do I do? How do I contact anyone?
Wake up. What about the first time you have a sleep and you wake up and you look for your mobile phone?
Oh.
So first morning you wake up in prison, you're looking for your phone and it's fucking not there. And it's this reality of, it's a real cold reality. Your first day in prison is like, fuck.
I remember, this is gonna hurt. I woke up in the middle of the night and I just seen like the orange light shine through the mesh and I'm just like, oh, fuck, it's not
and
a bad dream.
And the stench of that darcy unit stinks like nothing else. Stinks of death. And what happened? So what happened? You go to court.
So fast forward a little bit, I got moved to the Asian pod.
Good pod to live in, mate.
Yeah.
Best food.
I was there, so it was a working pod. Yeah, and then I was only there for a week, and then they tipped me off to Bathurst.
Oh, that's gut-wrenching.
That was an eye-opener for me. I thought, I can do time.
Did you go to winter? Were you in the winter or summer?
Winter, because it was in March. Yeah, it was about to, so it was a little bit hot still, but it was just about to be winter. So it was in March, and went out to Bathurst, and I remember my first night, they put me in a cell where it's half a mattress because the boys are cutting up the mattresses to make use pillows. Yeah. So I'm sleeping with half a mattress, and I'm like, oh, my God. And I went from having a TV in every cell because that's what they have at MRRC. Everyone's got a TV because you rent it for $2. To Bathurst, no TVs. No one's got TVs because everyone's blaming each other for a TV and stamping each other, and there's like all this politics over TVs. I'm in a cell with nothing but my thoughts.
Man, she's out there. I'm being trapped with your thoughts.
Nothing but my thoughts. And I was just like, oh, fuck. And I remember I wasn't used to lock-ins yet. At MRRC, I think they have training day once a week.
Yeah.
Lock-ins are fine because you got TV. Half day lock-in, whatever it is. Bathurst, sometimes it'll be like 3 day lock-ins at a time. And then I remember my cellie left and he moved in with one of his other boys because he was a Muslim bloke. So he moved in with one of his mates. And there was a cell downstairs. There was a guy with a green card. It was a Koori fella. He was a green card, but he wasn't all there. And
there's a lot of that, hey. You can get put in a cell with someone who's got a serious mental health issue, especially like schizophrenic and that. Man, that's dangerous, man.
It was a big eye-opener for me. And the screws put me in that cell and no TV, no nothing. Luckily, the guy was actually a nice guy. He was just a bit like not all there, but he was a crazy chess player.
Yeah.
He was an amazing chess player. He was probably the best in the yard. And I was in that cell for 3 days and I was just losing it. Like, I didn't say nothing, but I was just playing chess with him here and there, but I was just losing it in my mind.
Yeah.
And no books, no TV, no radio. Oh my God.
Isn't it? That's a real form of imprisonment sometimes, being trapped with your thoughts, eh?
That's And I didn't know how strong my thoughts were, like they were just in my mind, and I was just stressing out and thinking the same thing over and over again about how fucked I am and what's gone wrong in my life.
Yeah.
And
it's the catalyst for change though when you get put in those sort of situations.
But you know what, I didn't learn to appreciate how down I was until much later on.
Yeah.
So probably I spent like another 8 months in that pod. So I was in a C34 because they wouldn't let me over to the Asian wing because the Asian wing was the working wing and you had to be sentenced to go over there. And they wouldn't let me over because you had to be sentenced. That's what they were saying. And I kept seeing boys come into Bathurst and just going over to the working wing. And I wanted to go over there because I was just walking around the yard doing nothing all day. I wasn't training. I barely had a TV here and there because I'd rent one here and there for a packet of smokes. And there weren't many Asian boys in my wing too. So it was like a couple of island boys every now and then, but it was mainly Koori yard.
I just want to explain, Asians are very tight in jail.
Yeah.
Very tight. They will make an example of you.
It was the time that I was there, I was just hearing all those stories and it was starting to just change a little bit because all those guys like either stayed out or they were just heavy on the drugs towards like my time. So like they're old now, yeah? The guys that you knew back in your time, they're old now. And there's not much Asian boys coming through now and it's the ones that do come through, some of them are really soft. So it was like I was just in that transition period where I heard the stories of all the crazy boys and I got to meet some of them, but they were getting like old.
Watch the Asians take care of business.
I've seen it a couple of times. It was pretty honourable sometimes.
Mate, they got that. I remember at Goulburn, they were warned about a bloke. He was an Asian bloke. Yeah. He was a rapist, which is really uncommon.
Yeah.
And they were told, and it took him a year, and they said, no, we'll take care of him. And people were getting pissed off with him. They said, no. And then one day they just 20 of them all got him in one time. They all stabbed him. They all were committed to stabbing him. I think they all stabbed him three times and there was nothing left of him. That was them taking care of that. And they said to the Aussies, stay out of this.
Yeah.
We'll take care of our own. And they did it, you know what I mean? They were, I remember being up at Lithgow, man, and I remember one guy spilled some water on an old triad.
Yeah.
And didn't apologize.
Yeah.
Fucking fatal mistake, mate. They just locked him into the tennis court and just went to town on him. Fucking heavy duty. But the Asians, for me, I always got on well with the Asians because it's very similar. Give respect, get respect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was on the receiving end of some pretty fucking good feeds made out of nothing.
You know what? That's when I learned to cook too.
Yeah.
And I think when I finally got to move to A-Wing where all the older Asians were, that's when I really learned how to be a man.
Respect.
Yeah, a lot of respect and like a lot of the childish things that I was doing, I had the older boys there to pull me up.
Mm.
Like honestly.
Do you reckon it was the first time you had a real proper father figure in your life, you reckon?
Honestly, proper father figure, proper older brother, just someone to guide me a little bit because I remember I didn't want to be in this cell, but he forced me to be in this cell. Mm. He was one of the older Asian boys because I knew like the type of person he was. He was like, with his ways, old and setting his ways. But when I moved into his cell, he wouldn't talk about crime. He wouldn't talk like all the other cellmates that I had before that. Every time we get into the cell, what have you done? Should we link up? Yeah. Should we link up when we get out? This one time that I got put in this cell, I moved into his cell. He was like to me, "What's your family like out on the outside? Do you love your parents? What are you going to do for your parents when you get out? You're going to have to be a good son because if they've only got you in this lifetime, you need to look after them when you get out. You have to start doing, you have to start changing."
Yeah.
That's the first time like someone really ever told me any of these things. And then I started to think to myself, wow, okay, I need to start thinking about what my life is going to be like when I need to start doing something. And then they'd push me to train. I never wanted to train. Mm. I never wanted to train. And they would force me to train before and after work. And then because I was still the little brother of the group, I was still acting like the little brother.
Mm.
And then, long story short, I went back to Sydney for sentencing. So I spent a bit of time at Parkley and Windsor.
Mm.
And then I started to get to see some of the young Asian boys that were coming through. Yeah. And a lot of them were childish. And I just naturally stepped into kind of like one of the older boys' shoes.
Mm.
Because at that time, I was 25 now. I was starting to go to my late 20s.
Mm.
And I started.
How old are you now?
I'm 32.
Okay.
Yeah, 32 now. And then I got sentenced and they asked me, "What jail you want to go to?"
Mm.
I'm like, "All right, I want to stay."
How long did you have to go when you got sentenced?
I had 2 years left. So I'd done 2 years already. So
you'd been a C-class, so straight up. Yeah,
I had 2 years left and I'd just done 2 years. They sentenced me 4 years all on the bottom and they asked me, "What jail you want to go to?" And at that time, I spent so much time out at Bathurst and I was like, man, I just want to be close to home to my family. I wanted to stay in Sydney. Like, I didn't want them to travel 3 hours there, 3 hours back, get up at 4 a.m, and then spend, like, the whole weekend just to see me. I asked for the Sydney jail. They're like, "Nah, you can't have it. Too busy, too packed. Come back when you're C3. And I thought, oh, okay.
D3 is, classification of C3 means you can go on works release, you can go out on TAFE, you can leave the perimeter of the jail. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that was what they told me. Highly trusted. Yeah, that's what they told me I had to be to come back to Sydney.
Yeah.
And I go, all right, whatever. And the next best thing at the time, all the older boys were telling me, go to Oberon, bro. They got everything at Oberon. You got Foxtel. Yeah, Foxtel, you got ice cream. Yeah. It sounds great when you're in just like jail. Yeah. You're like, fuck, ice cream. Foxtel. Camps.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. All right, yeah, whatever. I'll bite the bullet. My parents are going to have to travel 3 hours to see me. My mates are going to have to travel.
Did they tell you there's snow up there?
Yeah, they told me that too. But at that time, I've never seen snow in my life. So it was exciting for me. Anyways, so I'm like, all right, class me to Oberon.
As the young offender, yeah?
Yeah, as a young offender. Because I was just, I was 24 at the time. Sorry, I was 24 at the time and I just made the mark. I went up to Oberon. And because the cutoff age was about 24, I happened to be one of the older boys out of the young boy. And that's when I really noticed, fuck, the way that these young boys were acting, that's the way I was acting at one stage of my life. And because I had those boys, the older boys, to help me mature, like I really, all the things that they taught me, I started realizing, fuck, man, I got to take control of my life. I got to be more disciplined. I got to look after the boys because if I didn't look after the boys, no one was.
Yeah.
And
you felt a bit of a responsibility, you know what I mean, to be that older brother with a positive role model. That's a good trait.
Yeah, it pushed me into those shoes because if I didn't look after the Asian boys, no one was going to look after the Asian boys. And I felt like I didn't, and when you're proud, you didn't want your people to be like the shit kicker group of the yard.
Yeah.
So I was like, nah, I got to keep the boys together.
I just took good pride in that.
Yeah, yeah. I had to keep the boys together. Yeah. Had to look after the boys. And there was this ongoing tradition that the boys had when one of the new Asian boys would come up to Oberon, would go around, see who's got food, and I put together a pack of food and just give it to the new buck. Mm. Here, bro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really matured when I went to Oberon.
Yeah, that's good. And what was the program like that up there? Talk about like that program. Look, I think corrective services get it so fucking wrong, but they get it right with that. Were you doing all the abseiling stuff and all that?
I did all of that, the abseiling, the camps. Mm. At that time when I was doing that program, corrective services, they don't actually – they have someone else run that program who's not actually an officer.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. But we hated him for some reason. I don't know why we hated him. We just, maybe because of the way he was or.
Yeah.
But he was always like, look, you guys can either take this program seriously or not seriously. It's up to you. But if you take it seriously, I promise you that your life is going to change.
Mm.
I took it seriously, but not seriously. Like, I didn't think too much about all the things that we'll do inside the classrooms.
Mm.
And I didn't take too much of the lessons that he was trying to teach us when we were out on camp. Because one, he's not a relatable person.
Mm.
So you don't really take it on board. And you're like, who the fuck's this guy telling me what to do?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the way I was feeling. Yeah, yeah. But I still done everything that was needed to be done. Like I completed the programs, the classroom programs. I completed all the camps.
Mm.
I completed all the abseiling. I done everything. But in my mind, I was just like, oh, who the fuck's this guy? You know, and I wasn't really thinking too much of it. But the main thing about the program was they'd get us to do in the classrooms, small things like talk about like how much our crime costed us, how much did we make from our crime, small things like that.
Accountability.
But I didn't really think too much of it. It was the camps that really hit me because there's three camps that you got to do. The first one is 2 days, one night. Second one's 3 days, two nights. And the last one's just 2 days, one night again, but it's like a kickback one, the last one. The first one was you'd walk through the mountains for a whole 2 days and one night you'd camp. And it wasn't like what you're on Instagram where the guys go on the trails and they're wearing their Nike shoes. It was old army boots or camping boots that 1,000 people have worn before you. And the only way to make it comfortable is put dishwashing sponges into the soles of the shoes where your toes would go so you wouldn't hurt your feet.
Mm.
That was the only way. And it wasn't like you're walking through the fire trail. You're walking through bushland.
Rugged rocks. Terrain.
Very rugged terrain.
Mm.
And rain, hail, shine, snow, it didn't matter what day. Whatever day it fell on, that's the day you're going camping. Mm. Regardless. And I remember it was my 25th birthday.
What was the purpose of that, do you think? What do you think it was, to build resilience? What was the purpose?
I felt like it was to build resilience and just really push us.
Mm.
You look around at your intake. So intake was the group of boys that came together and they'll do the whole program together and stick it out together for the whole, I think it was 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And I remember walking through the bush the first time. It was a rude shock to me. I'm like, fuck, when does this end, man? It's raining and can we just sit down? Like, it's never ending. And it wasn't like you're walking without anything. It was you're walking with your backpack, which is carrying your food and your water, your camping tarp, which was basically our tent was just a rope and a tarp. That was our camping tent. So they were pushing us, giving us the bare minimum, but at the same time, like really teaching us like within these hard yards.
Yeah.
And then that first camp.
Do you think you took, like in your life today, do you think you took much out of that? Do you think it had an impact on your life today?
I think it put me so far in the depths of struggle. Like I hated every second that I was out there. And
but you love it now.
Yeah, I love it now. Because every time I'm training hard now, I think back to that moment where I'm like, fuck, this is not as hard as that. To be dirty and muddy and not forced to carry your food to walk through for no purpose. You're just walking for the sake of walking. It's not like you had to walk to get somewhere to go home. It's you're walking to go back to jail.
Yeah.
There's no purpose behind it. They're just forcing you to walk. And I remember it was that night, it was my 25th birthday on the first camp. First camp, midnight, it was going to be my 25th birthday, and I was sitting at the campfire, and I remember I was sitting around with a couple of the boys, and I was just staring into the campfire, and I'm like, fuck, I'm 25. What's going on in my life? Like, a quarter of my life is gone, like, assuming that I'll live to 100 if I'm even going to make it, but that's at least a quarter of my life gone. What am I doing with my life? I get out, I got no money, I got no job. I have to start from scratch. Like, where are all my mates now? And at the age, all my mates were like finishing uni, they were getting married, they were getting engaged, buying a house, starting a business. All these things I was getting from my letters and hearing from my phone calls and all the photos I was seeing. I was missing out on all these weddings and engagement parties. And I was just looking at the photos, I'm like, fuck, I should be there. I should be there. I should be at all these things, my mates' kids' first birthdays and baby showers. I'm missing out on everything. And I remember just sitting there staring in the campfire. I'm like, fuck, I can't believe I'm missing out on everything. And by the time I get out, I'm going to be 27. I've got nothing to my name. By then, nearly three-tenths of my life, 30% of my life is gone, and I've done nothing. I've got nothing to show for it.
Yeah.
What can I do? I was stressing out, but I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to have to just look at what's in front of me right now. What's in front of me? The next day of hard walking, and then the second camp is a three-day walk where apparently you walk deep into the valley and walk for 2 hours straight back up to the top of the mountain. And all the boys that were back at the jail that already done the camps, they were all telling us the same thing. They'll go, bro, wait until you do the motivator camp. That's the worst and the ugliest camp that you're ever going to do.
And they always color it in, eh?
Yeah. So everyone knew that was the hard one. Yeah. That was going to be the super hard one. And I was just sitting there at the campfire thinking, that's going to be the super hard one. And I'm sitting here struggling on this one.
Yeah.
What can I do to make that second one a little bit more easier? So I thought, all right, you know what? That's it. I made up my mind. When I get back, I'm going to train super hard as I can, be as fit as I can, build a physically capable body, so I can do that second camp easy. So that's the only thing I need to worry about. So as soon as I got back to the jail after that camp, one of my mates was training, and I was like, bro, let's go. Let's train 20 to 1 burpees. We'll do 20 burpees, 19, all the way down to 1. I was the only one out of my intake to train as soon as we got back to the jail. And I thought, nah, that's it from here on out. I have to be ready for this next camp. I refuse to be one of the guys that were struggling. I refused to struggle. I refused to have a hard time. Don't get me wrong, that second camp was hard. It was actually hard, but I remember looking around and there were guys that were struggling.
Yeah.
There were guys that were absolutely struggling, and I thought, that's not me. And then from there on, I never stopped training.
In that. There's a good lesson in that. There's a good, that the importance of preparation, huh?
And, there was one thing that happened on that second camp. I remember we got to the top of the mountain, and the coordinator, the program's coordinator, was like, guys, how good does this view look? And we looked back from the top of the mountain, and I remember seeing like just nice bushland trees and a fresh air coming in. And I remember that fresh air. And he's like, all right, guys, do you think that this view would look as good if you took an elevator up here or an escalator? And I thought about it. Nah, not really. And then he's like, why is that? And I'm like, because we worked hard for it. We climbed the mountain.
Great analogy.
Yeah, and it is exactly. It's the same thing in life. If you want to earn a lot of money, if you earn it the legit way, it's going to feel so much more empowering that you've done it. And I stopped and I thought for a bit and I go, man, I think he's right. But at the same time, I'm still in the mindset, well, what's this guy know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like he's not relatable. He's not a relatable person. So I'm still thinking that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I go, he does have a point. He does have a point. But like I've had the taste of, like drug money, and it felt good.
Yeah,
it felt good. A lot of money felt good.
But and even at that stage, you look back on the drug money and the easy money in a ring, you're still glorifying it a bit, aren't you? The reality hasn't really set in, because in the back of your mind, you're going back to it.
Yeah. Exactly. And in the back of my mind, the only people that I know is all the people that I've made connections with and networked with, got their MIN numbers, got their contacts, got their Instagrams, whatever. Like I've made all these connections, and that's all I have, and that's all I know, and that's all I'm getting out to in my mind. And then what happened? Got back to the jail and I felt amazing. I thought, wow, this is where my life changes from here. I never stopped training from that day. And the third camp, walk in the park, because the third camp, we actually just walked to it's like a reward camp where we go out there, walk for maybe an hour, set up the campsite and we just hang out for the rest of the day and night, which was pretty good.
It's a lot like life though, isn't it, mate? You put in the hard yards, it gets easier as you go along. If you just do that foundation work and so the rest, I think I love the structure of that program. It's really good. So tell me, how did you come in contact with ConFit? Where did that start to play a part in?
Oh, so funny story. Every jail I was at, the boys were like to me, bro, do you know Joe Kwan? Is that your older brother?
Yeah, you look alike.
Yeah.
I don't mean a stereotype.
Trust me, I've gotten that from everyone. It's normal. It's normal. Yeah. Everyone's like, you sure, man? Because even at the time, like, Joe was like one of the only Asian guys that was training really hard and he was big and he had that mindset like when he was training. Anyways, when I started training hard, all the boys were like, man, this guy reminds me of Joe Kwan. Do you know Joe Kwan?
Mm.
And I'm like, nah, I don't know Joe Kwan.
Kwan's the founder of ConFit Pathways,
Shout out to Joe.
Shout out to you, Joe. Yeah. Love you, mate.
Everyone was like to me, do you know Joe? I'm like, I've never met this person before, but I keep hearing about him. And then I got back to Sydney, got my work release C3.
Where'd you do that? At a Park Lee or Silverwater?
At Silverwater, yeah. Dawn Delois, yeah.
Yeah, fucking shit on.
I went from Foxtel back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I went back to Sydney, done my C3. I went to this job site, Duffy Kennedy job site, and the foreman had Joe there just before me.
Mm.
And same thing, he was like to me, bro, you remind me of this guy named Joe Kwan. Do you know Joe Kwan? No, I don't know no Joe Kwan. And I remember they were telling me like Joe's plans to build ConFit when he was on the job site. So he already had this vision. He already had all this vision planned out like when he was inside jail still doing work release. So I was like, nah, I don't really know, but like it sounded like a great idea. And then I got out and I seen Joe's boot camp start to blow up on socials. So I followed him and then he followed me back and he sends me a message and he goes, hey, bro, we got a lot of mutuals, eh? And I'm like, yeah, bro, like I heard about you when I was inside. It's great to like finally connect. And then so me and him were following each other's stuff for a while. I got into coaching because he got out, I think, like a year before me. And so he was already a couple of steps ahead of me. And I thought, man, if this guy
you can achieve a lot in a year, can you?
Yeah, you can. And like at that time, I hadn't become a PT yet. I was just working in between a construction job and Audi, the supermarket pickpacking. And I was just watching him be a coach from afar and I was just like, man, if he can do it, I can do it. So I wanted to be a PT too. So I became a coach, PT. Long story short, he started the ConFit Pathways. And I remember when I saw that and it gave me a new sense of purpose because I thought helping people and helping people as a coach is great, but I want to help someone that's struggling and it's going through that, what I went through. I want to help like the younger boys.
Yeah.
And some of these boys, they don't have they're not blessed with the things that I have now. Wouldn't it be great to help out? And it was just like that time of the new year time. And I was just looking for a purpose in life. And when I saw the first video that Joe put out for ConFit Pathways, I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to help young boys. Young boys who are struggling, who are lost, and they need a bit of guidance. Because when I learned about fitness, I had to just figure it out for myself. When I was inside, just picking bits and pieces from different boys that I trained with, seeing what works. I wish I had someone there to coach me. So that's how I got into ConFit. Yeah, that's how I messaged Joe straight away. And he's like, bro, we need new boys on the team. Come next week, Thursday. Let's go. And I'd done my first session with the boys. I remember it was at Cobham. The moment I walked out, it was like my soul felt so light. Like I felt like I was finally doing something that was right in my life.
It's a good feeling. It's rewarding. And that feeling of giving back is just unparalleled.
Yeah, because like I remember I was like just training with the boys and I know what they're going through and they were telling me what they were feeling and they were like lost in their lives. And I felt like some of the talks that I had, they were taking away from it, using what I was giving them. And When I walked out of the juvie that day, it was, if this is what I was meant to do, then I'm happy.
Universe will do that to you, mate. Universe will steer you in the right direction.
What's funny, Russ, after school, when I went to TAFE, I didn't know what I wanted to do when I went to uni. And I thought, I'll be a primary school teacher. I'll get to teach the next generation. It'll give me school holidays. It'll be nice and relaxing. So I go, you know what? I want to be a primary school teacher. I got it locked up, obviously, for the supply charges. And then when I got out, I actually messaged the Department of Education, tried to inquire about following my degree still. And they're like, listen, you got too many charges. You're not fit to be a male school teacher for primary school. Yeah. And then now I'm not a school teacher, but I get to help the boys still. I get to teach.
In a greater capacity. I think in a greater capacity, because I think lived experience, with those kids that you're talking about, I think they see through frauds. And they know you've been there. I think we speak for our eyes. I can look at another person who's been there and go, yeah, even if I just catch eyes with people in the street, you can spot another cream or whatever. Yeah. It's like, yeah, that bloke's a cream. Doesn't want to be noticed, but that's okay, but away. So keep walking. But those kids are really receptive to lived experience. And I'll talk about it a lot of it now. I think we've got some real serious problems with the youth crime. But them kids need to be talking to people like yourself, like myself, like Joe, people that are relatable to them.
Yeah, and they need to know that that's not the life that you have to go down later on. You learn what you learn from there and then apply it somewhere else.
Yeah, look at young Kaiser. We had him here a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, man, he's doing amazing things. What's funny, I catch up with Kaiser like every couple of weeks or every week or two, like even if it's just a phone call.
Mm.
And it amazes me how mature and how much he's grown as the weeks go on. Like we talk, like even though there's like a 10-year age gap between me and him, I talk to him. He's like my brother. Like we're like only a year apart.
He's the real deal. My young bloke was in
oh, yeah, that's what he told me.
Baxter,
yeah.
Yeah, my young bloke was in Baxter with him. And he was saying, Dad, he was the leader. He was the man. Yeah, it's good to see that. And you know what? I love the effects that it's having. You look at a kid like him, and you've obviously played a part in how he is. That must feel so good, brother. It must feel much better than selling drugs and have a pocket full of cash.
Exactly. I would not trade my life now for all the money as a drug dealer. Yeah. I would not trade my life that I have now for, like, you could offer me $10 million, but the catch was you got to be a drug dealer.
Yeah.
I would not trade that life for what I have now and the impact that I've created.
There's a saying, and it's in a song, it's an honest man's pillow is his peace of mind. I love it.
That's a good one, man. That's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah, I like it. And it's what we do. How does it, like, you've found your purpose, and how is important, like, we're talking about these kids getting into trouble. How important is it for a kid to find their purpose?
It's so important because they're young. They don't know that they have a purpose. I think the system just drills them in the sense that, oh, you guys are just part of the system. You're just a number. You're not going to fulfill, you're not going to do anything great in life. You're just going to be another number. They give you a min number and that's it for the rest of your life. And I think they never believe that they're going to do anything great.
And that's that narrative. That's that narrative in them places, isn't it? You just get used to this. I went and seen my son at Baxter and they were just prepping him for jail.
Exactly. Oh, man, it's what do they call it? It's like the high school before jail. Yeah. You graduate to high school.
Graduate
to jail, yeah.
What would you say to a young Andrew these days? What would you say to that 15-year-old kid that was trying to get acceptance at school looking for a big brother?
I would say to him, and I say this to the kids a lot actually, I always tell them your life is your fault because your life will depend on the actions that you take every single day, and that includes if you decide to spend 6 hours playing games, you decide to spend all day doing nothing, like all those things compound into where your life is going to end up.
Yeah.
So if you spend all day not learning anything, not getting educated, not learning from people, from other people who have been there, it doesn't hurt to just message someone and ask for help.
Mate, you're training right now for a fight, boxing fight.
Yeah, I'm training for a fight, yeah. I wish I told I'd tell my 15-year-old self to go to a fight gym.
Yeah. What about that? And I use boxing as an analogy of life. Of success. Yeah. I've had heaps. I've had Danny Green, Jeff Fenwick, Johnny Lewis. I've had some really good fighters on this program. Paul Fleming, Shannon O'Connell. I love fighters. I love interviews. And I love people with the fighting spirit because the analogy of boxing is you take shortcuts, you get hurt.
Yep.
Same in life.
Yep.
If you're committed, you'll get results.
Yeah.
If you take sacrifice, you'll get results. If you get knocked down, you get back up. Boxing's a great analogy of life.
I wish that I learnt the boxing principles a lot earlier. I only got into boxing seriously 6 months ago.
Yeah. Great sport.
It is. It is. And it's
a violent game of chess.
Yeah, you can't cheat your way, and you have to show up every day.
Yeah.
And there's going to be days where you don't feel like showing up, but you have to go and do the work anyway.
And I don't mean to offend Christians when I say this, but boxing saved more troubled lives than Jesus. You know what I mean? I really do. You know what I mean? Mate, you've got an amazing personal growth. You've got a beautiful personal growth. I love your journey's amazing, and it's inspirational to a lot of kids. And you, how does it feel knowing that you're inspiring other troubled kids? Wow.
I'm still in disbelief because, like, every now and then I'll get like a message from one of the guys who's done our program, and I'm very well connected with all the young boys that do our program. Like, I stay in a lot of contact with them. So a lot of the boys that we meet inside juvie, I'll stay in contact with them.
How often do you go out to the juvies? Twice a week.
Yeah, twice a week. So on Thursdays we're at Cobham, Frank Baxter on Fridays.
Yeah.
So two different groups of boys.
They're heavy duty, these kids that come through now, eh?
Yeah, man. Some of them, I don't even know what they're feeding them. Some of them are big boys.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, they're good kids. Yeah. They're just a little bit misguided. And when they get out and they start trying to, like, find the right path in life or trying to get their life back on track, and then they'll send me random messages, and they're always, like, thank you messages. And I'm still in disbelief of, like, how something so small as, you know, just posting my own content in terms of what I do in training, my own thoughts, how I've, like, the things that I'm doing every day to work on my business to improve myself as a coach.
Yeah.
Like,
that's important, isn't
it? Yeah. Like, it's important that they see these things because they find hope in it. And they sometimes they'll just message me just to say thank you for everything. And I'll have some kids that just got out of Baxter recently and they're working at the Confit gym. And they tell me, bro, I watch every single one of your stories. I like every single one of your posts, man. It keeps me grounded to do what I need to do to get to where I want to get to.
Yeah. And how do people find you, man?
You can find me through the Confit Pathways page or the Confit Gym page. I handle those pages too. But my personal page is One Out Training.
On Insta?
Yeah, on Insta, One Out Training. I have a YouTube channel called One Out TV. I use TikTok too, One Out Training. Yeah, for those that don't know what One Out means, like, for me, I had to learn how to train by myself after I left Oberon.
That's the Rob Banks One Out. That was my terminology, but anyway.
Yeah, hey, independent. Yeah, one independent, out. You had to do a One Out. Yeah.
But, man, you've got an amazing story, and I love what you do. It's amazing how the community in general has accepted the whole Confit thing. It's a credit to all of you because you're all contributors. And, mate, congratulations, man. It's been a pleasure having you on, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. What's up?